A Cumberland Vendetta. I. The cave had been their hiding place as children. It was a secret refuge now against hunger or darkness when they were hunting in the woods. The primitive meal was finished, ashes were raked over the red coals, the slice of bacon and the little bag of meal were hung high against the rock wall, and the two stepped from the cavern into a thicket of rhododendrons. Parting the bushes toward the dim light, they stood on a massive shoulder of the mountain, the river girding it far below, and the afternoon shadows at their feet. Both carried guns, the tall mountaineer, a Winchester, the boy, a squirrel rifle longer than himself. Climbing about the rocky spur, they kept the same level over log and boulder and through bushy ravine to the north. In half an hour, they ran into a path that led up home from the river, and they stopped to rest on a cliff that sank in a solid black wall straight under them. The sharp edge of a steep cornfield ran near, and, stripped of blade and tassel, the stalks and hooded ears looked in the coming dusk a little like monks at prayer. In the sunlight across the river the corn stood thin and frail. Over there a drought was on it, and when drifting thistle plumes marked the noontide of the year, each yellow stalk had withered blades and an empty sheath. Everywhere a look of vague trouble lay upon the face of the mountains, and when the wind blew, the silver of the leaves showed ashen. Autumn was at hand. There was no physical sign of kinship between the two, half-brothers though they were. The tall one was dark, the boy, a foundling, had flaxen hair, and was stunted and slender. He was a dreamy-looking little fellow, and one may easily find his like throughout the Cumberland paler than his fellows, from staying much indoors, with half-haunted face, and eyes that are deeply pathetic when not cunning, ignorantly credited with idiocy and uncanny powers, treated with much forbearance, some awe, and a little contempt, and suffered to do his pleasure nothing, or much that is strange without comment. "I tell ye, Rome," he said, taking up the thread of talk that was broken at the cave, "when Uncle Gabe says he's afeard thar's trouble calm, hit's a calm, and I want you to get me a Winchester. I'm aged and big enough now. I can shoot might nigh as good as you, and what am I fit fare with this high old paw-paw popgun? I don't want you fightin', boy, I've told ye. Ye you air too little and puny, and I want ye to stay home and take care of mam and the cattle if fightin' does come. I reckon thar won't be trench. Don't ye?" cried the boy, with sharp contempt, "with old Jaslow Wallin a devil and Uncle Roof, and that black-headed young Jass a climbin' on stumps over thar across the river, and crowin' and sayin' out open in Hazelin that ye air afeard o' him? Yes, and he called me a idjit." The boy's voice broke into a whimper of rage. "Shut up, Isom. Don't you go jittin' mad now. You'll be sick again. I'll tend to him when the time comes." Rome spoke with rough kindness, but ugly lines had gathered at his mouth and forehead. The boy's tears came and went easily. He drew his sleeve across his eyes, and looked up the river. Beyond the bend, three huge birds rose into the sunlight and floated toward them. Close at hand, they swerved sidewise. "They hain't buzzards," he said, standing up, his anger gone, "look at them straight wings." Again the eagles swerved, and two shot across the river. The third dropped with shut wings to the bare crest of a gaunt old poplar under them. "Hit's a young un, Romy," said the boy, excitedly. "He's going to wait thar till the old un's come back. Gimme that gun." Catching up the Winchester, he slipped over the ledge, and Rome leaned suddenly forward, looking down at the river. A group of horsemen had ridden around the bend, and were coming at a walk down the other shore. Every man carried something across his saddle bow. There was a gray horse among them, young Jasper's, and an evil shadow came into Rome's face, and quickly passed. Near a strip of woods the gray turned up the mountain from the party, and on its back he saw the red glint of a woman's dress. With a half-smile he watched the scarlet figure ride from the woods, and climb slowly up through the sunny corn. On the spur above and full in the rich yellow light, she halted, half-turning in her saddle. He rose to his feet, to his full height, his head bare, and thrown far back between his big shoulders, and, still as statues, the man and the woman looked at each other across the gulf of darkening air. A full minute the woman sat motionless, then rode on. At the edge of the woods she stopped and turned again. The eagle under Rome leapt one stroke in the air, and dropped like a clod into the sea of leaves. The report of the gun and a faint cry of triumph rose from below. It was good marksmanship, but on the cliff Rome did not heed it. Something had fluttered in the air above the girl's head, and he laughed aloud. She was waving her bonnet at him, too. Just where young Stetson stood, the mountains racing along each bank of the Cumberland had sent out against each other, by mutual impulse, two great spurs. At the river's brink they stopped sheer, with crests uplifted, as though some hand at the last moment had hurled them apart, and had led the water through the breach to keep them at peace. Today the crags looked seamed by thwarted passion, And, sullen with furs, they made fit symbols of the human hate about the base of each. When the feud began, no one knew. Even the original cause was forgotten. Both families had come as friends from Virginia long ago, and had lived as enemies nearly half a century. There was hostility before the war, but, until then, little bloodshed. Through the hatred of change, characteristic of the mountain era the world over, the Lawalans were for the Union. The Stetsons owned a few slaves, and they fought for them. Peace found both still neighbors and worse foes. The war armed them, and brought back an ancestral contempt for human life. It left them a heritage of lawlessness that for mutual protection made necessary the very means used by their feudal forefathers. Personal hatred supplanted its dead issues, and with them the war went on. The Stetsons had a good strain of Anglo-Saxon blood, and owned valley lands. The Llewellyns kept store and made moonshine, so kindred and debtors and kindred and tenants were arrayed with one or the other leader, and gradually the retainers of both settled on one or the other side of the river. In time of hostility the Cumberland came to be the boundary between life and death for the dwellers on each shore. It was feudalism born again. Above one of the spurs each family had its home, the Stetsons, under the seared face of Thunderstruck Knob, the Llewellyns, just beneath the wooded rim of Wolf's Head. The eaves and chimney of each cabin were faintly visible from the porch of the other. The first light touched the house of the Stetsons, the last, the Llewellyn cabin. So there were times when the one could not turn to the sunrise nor the other to the sunset but with a curse in his heart, for his eye must fall on the home of his enemy. For years there had been peace. The death of Rome Stetson's father from ambush, and the fight in the courthouse square, had forced it. After that fight only four were left: old Jasper Llewellyn and young Jasper, the boy Rome and his uncle, Rufe Stetson. Then Rufe fled to the west, and the Stetsons were helpless. For 3 years no word was heard of him, but the hatred burned in the heart of Rome's mother, and was traced deep in her grim old face while she patiently waited the day of retribution. It smoldered, too, in the hearts of the women of both clans who had lost husbands or sons or lovers, and the friends and kin of each had little to do with one another, and met and passed with watchful eyes. Indeed, it would take so little to turn peace to war that the wonder was that peace had lived so long. Now trouble was at hand. Rufe Stetson had come back at last, a few months since, and had quietly opened store at the county seat, Hazlin, a little town 5 miles up the river, where troubled Fork runs seething into the Cumberland, a point of neutrality for the factions, and consequently a battleground. Old Jasper's store was at the other end of the town, and the old man had never been known to brook competition. He had driven 3 men from Hazlin during the last term of peace for this offense, and everybody knew that the fourth must leave or fight. Already Rufe Stetson had been warned not to appear outside his door after dusk. Once or twice his wife had seen skulking shadows under the trees across the road, and a tremor of anticipation ran along both banks of the Cumberland. 3. A fortnight later, court came. Rome was going to Hazlin, and the feeble old Stetson mother limped across the porch from the kitchen, trailing a Winchester behind her. Usually he went unarmed, but he took the gun now, as she gave it, in silence. The boy Isom was not well, and Rome had told him to ride the horse. But the lad had gone on afoot to his duties at old Gabe Bunch's mill, and Rome himself rode down Thunderstruck Knob through the mist and dew of the early morning. The sun was coming up over Virginia, and through a dip in Black Mountain the foothills beyond washed in blue waves against its white disk. A little way down the mountain, the rays shot through the gap upon him, and, lancing the mist into tatters, and lighting the dewdrops, set the birds singing. Rome rode, heedless of it all, under primeval oak and poplar, and along rain-clear brooks and happy waterfalls, shut in by laurel and rhododendron, and singing past mossy stones and lace-like ferns that brushed his stirrup. On the brow of every cliff he would stop to look over the trees and the river to the other shore, where the gray line of a path ran aslant Wolf's Head, and was lost in woods above and below. At the river he rode upstream, looking still across it. Old Gabe Bunch hallooed to him from the doorway of the mill, as he splashed through the creek, and Isom's thin face peered through a breach in the logs. At the ford beyond, he checked his horse with a short oath of pleased surprise. Across the water, a scarlet dress was moving slowly past a brown field of corn. The figure was bonneted, but he knew the girl's walk and the poise of her head that far away. Just who she was, however, he did not know, and he sat irresolute. He had seen her first a month since, paddling along the other shore, erect, and with bonnet off and hair down, she had taken the Llewellyn path up the mountain. Afterward, he saw her going at a gallop on young Jasper's gray horse, bareheaded again, and with her hair loose to the wind, and he knew she was one of his enemies. He thought her the girl people said young Jasper was going to marry, and he had watched her the more closely. From the canoe she seemed never to notice him, but he guessed, from the quick and sweep of her paddle, that she knew he was looking at her, and once, when he halted on his way home up the mountain, she half turned in her saddle and looked across at him. This happened again, and then she waved her bonnet at him. It was bad enough, any Stetson seeking any LaWallen for a wife, and for him to court young Jasper's sweetheart it was a thought to laugh at. But the mischief was done. The gesture thrilled him, whether it meant defiance or goodwill, and the mere deviltry of such a courtship made him long for it at every sight of her with the river between them. At once he began to plan how he should get near her, but, through some freak, she had paid no further heed to him. He saw her less often for a week, indeed, he had not seen her at all till this day, and the forces that hindrance generates in an imperious nature had been at work within him. The chance now was one of gold, and with his life in his hand he turned into the stream. Across, he could see something white on her shoulder, an empty bag. It was grinding day, and she was going to the mill, the LaWallen mill. She stopped as he galloped up, and turned, pushing back her bonnet with one hand, and he drew rein. But the friendly, expectant light in her face kindled to such a blaze of anger in her eyes that he struck his horse violently, as though the beast had stopped of its own accord, and, cursing himself, kept on. A little farther, he halted again. Three horsemen, armed with Winchesters, were jogging along toward town ahead of him, and he wheeled about sharply. The girl, climbing rapidly toward Steve Braden's cabin, was out of the way, but he was too late to reach the fort again. Down the road two more LaWallens with guns were in sight, and he lashed his horse into the stream where the water was deep. Old Gabe, looking from the door of his mill, quit laughing to himself, and under cover of the woods, the girl watched man and horse fighting the tide. Twice young Stetson turned his head. But his enemies apparently had not seen him, and horse and rider scrambled up the steep bank and under shelter of the trees. The girl had evidently learned who he was. Her sudden anger was significant, as was the sight of the LaWallens going armed to court, and Rome rode on, uneasy. When he reached Troubled Fork, inside of Hazelin, he threw a cartridge into place and shifted the slide to see that it was ready for use. Passing old Jasper's store on the edge of the town, he saw the old man's bushy head through the open door, and LaWallens and Braytons crowded out on the steps and looked after him. All were armed. 20 paces farther he met young Jasper on his gray, and the look on his enemy's face made him grip his rifle. With a flashing crossfire from eye to eye, the two passed, each with his thumb on the hammer of his Winchester. The groups on the courthouse steps stopped talking as he rode by, and turned to look at him. He saw none of his own friends, and he went on at a gallop to Rufe Stetson's store. His uncle was not in sight. Steve Markham and old Sam Day stood in the porch, and inside a woman was crying. Several Stetsons were near, and all with grave faces gathered about him. He knew what the matter was before Steve spoke. His uncle had been driven from town. A last warning had come to him on the day before. The hand of a friend was in the caution, and Rufe rode away at dusk. That night his house was searched by men masked and armed. The LaWallens were in town, and were ready to fight. The crisis had come. 4. Back at the mill, old Gabe was troubled. Usually he sat in a cane-bottomed chair near the hopper, whittling, while the lad tended the mill, and took pay in an oaken toll dish smooth with the use of half a century. But the incident across the river that morning had made the old man uneasy, and he moved restlessly from his chair to the door, and back again, while the boy watched him, wondering what the matter was, but asking no questions. At noon an old mountaineer rode by, and the miller hailed him. "Any news in town?" he asked. "Hain't been to town. Reckon fightin's going on thar from what I heard." The careless, high-pitched answer brought the boy with wide eyes to the door. "What do you hear?" asked Gabe. "Jess heard fightin's going on." Then every man who came for his meal brought a wild rumor from town, and the old miller moved his chair to the door, and sat there whittling fast, and looking anxiously toward Hazelin. The boy was in a fever of unrest, and old Gabe could hardly keep him in the mill. In the middle of the afternoon the report of a rifle came down the river, breaking into echoes against the cliffs below, and Isom ran out the door, and stood listening for another, with an odd contradiction of fear and delight on his eager face. In a few moments Rome Stetson galloped into sight, and, with a shrill cry of relief, the boy ran down the road to meet him, and ran back, holding by a stirrup. Young Stetson's face was black with passion, and his eyes were heavy with drink. At the door of the mill he swung from his horse, and for a moment was hardly able to speak from rage. There had been no fight. The Stetsons were few and unprepared. They had neither the guns nor, without Rufe, the means to open the war, and they believed Rufe had gone for arms. So they had chafed in the store all day, and all day LaWallens on horseback and on foot were in sight, and each was a taunt to every Stetson, and, few as they were, The young and hot-headed wanted to go out and fight. In the afternoon, a talebearer had brought some of Jasper's boasts to Rome, and, made reckless by moonshine and much brooding, he sprang up to lead them. Steve Markham, too, caught up his gun, but old Sam's counsel checked him, and the two by force held Rome back. A little later the Llewellyns left town. The Stetsons, too, disbanded, and on the way home a last drop of gall ran Rome's cup of bitterness over. Opposite Steve Braden's cabin a jet of smoke puffed from the bushes across the river, and a bullet furrowed the road in front of him. That was the shot they had heard at the mill. Somebody was drawing a deadline, and Rome wheeled his horse at the brink of it. A mocking yell came over the river, and a gray horse flashed past an open space in the bushes. Rome knew the horse and knew the yell. Young Jasper was bantering him. Nothing maddens the mountaineer like this childish method of insult, and telling of it, Rome sat in a corner, and loosed a torrent of curses against young Llewellyn and his clan. Old Gabe had listened without a word, and the strain in his face was eased. Always the old man had stood for peace. He believed it had come after the courthouse fight, and he had hoped against hope, even when Rufe came back to trade against old Jasper, for Rufe was big and good-natured, and unsuspected of resolute purpose, and the Llewellyn's power had weakened. So, now that Rufe was gone again, the old miller half believed he was gone for good. Nobody was hurt, there was a chance yet for peace, and with a rebuke on his tongue and relief in his face, the old man sat back in his chair and went on whittling. The boy turned eagerly to a crevice in the logs and, trembling with excitement, searched the other bank for Jasper's gray horse, going home. "He called me Idiot," he said to himself, with a threatening shake of his head. "Jess, wouldn't I like to have a chance at him? Rome will get him. Rome will get him." There was no moving point of white on the broad face of the mountains nor along the river road. Jasper was yet to come and, with ears alert to every word behind him, the lad fixed his eyes where he should see him first. "Oh, he didn't mean to hit me. Not that he ain't mean enough to shoot from the brush," Rome broke out savagely. "That's just what I'm afeared he will do. Thar was too much daylight fair him. Ef he just don't come a sneakin' over high e, and waitin' in the laurel atter dark fair me, it's all I ex." Waitin' in the laurel. Old Gabe could hold back no longer. "Hit's a shame, a burnin' shame. I don't know what things air come to. Pears like all you young folks think about is killin' somebody. Folks usen to talk about how fair they could kill a deer, now it's how fair they can kill a man. I have knowed the time when a man would a been druv out of the county fair drawin' a knife or a pistol, and if a feller was ever killed, it was kinder accidental, by a Barlow. I reckon folks got used to weepons and killin' and bushwhackin' in the war. Looks like it's been jittin' wuss ever since, and now hits Dirk and Winchester, and shootin' from the bushes all the time. Hits wasn't stealin' money to take a feller creature's life that way." The old miller's indignation sprang from memories of a better youth. For the courtesies of the code went on to the bluegrass, and before the war the mountaineer fought with English fairness in his fists. It was a disgrace to use a deadly weapon in those days, it was a disgrace now not to use it. "Oh, I know all the excuses folks make," he went on. "Hits far fair one as 'tis fair t'other, ye you can't fight a man far and square, he'll shoot you in the